Hello and welcome back to Chronicled, the history of Newcastle United. I'm Matt Ketchell, the North East Football App and Engagement Editor here at Chronicle Live. And we've reached episode 8 of our walk through the history of Newcastle United. Last week, we covered Newcastle United and World War I, documenting how the club coped during that significant period and the amazing contribution of many of its players and staff. Today, for episode 8, we're covering 1920 to 1924, the World War I recovery and the club's first visit to the brand spanking new Empire Stadium in Wembley. As ever, I'm joined by Newcastle United's official historian, Paul Joannou, and today we have a special guest in Dr. Dan Jackson, a fellow Geordie, an historian and author of a fantastic book, The Northumbrians, Northeast England and Its People, A New History. Dan has also been a historical advisor to War Cheryl Tweedy too, so great to have him with us. Dan, starting with you, welcome to the podcast. When I had the idea for this series, you were one of the first names that popped into my head to join us as a guest. You're ubiquitous on Twitter, sharing amazing historical content, not necessarily just football or even the Northeast, but always fascinating stuff. I'd love it if you could just give us a bit of a background on yourself, your expertise and your history as a Newcastle fan.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Thanks for the invitation. Like you said, I wrote the book, The Northumbrians, which was an attempt to get underneath why the Northeast of England is still so distinctive and the people that come from the Northeast are so recognisable, their character traits also recognisable to the rest of the country. I use the term Northumbrians because it was more ecumenical, because there's a kind of Geordie and Mackham division that's become even more pronounced over the last couple of decades. But it wasn't always like that. And we might touch on that later on, how, you know, football support used to be a bit less tribal. But I was looking for a term that tried to describe the land between the Tweed and the Tees and the shared characteristics and culture within that place. And yeah, there's a chapter in my book called Hard Work and Hedonism. The Northeast was always characterized by hard work in the heaviest of heavy industries. And from that world emerged a distinctive culture, and football was a key part of that. When you were used to hard, grueling labor and working in teams, it's no surprise that that transferred pretty easily onto the battlefield, which I'm very interested in, but also the football field as well.
Definitely. And you will have to explain the Cheryl Tweedy reference, otherwise some listeners might get confused. You had a television appearance with Cheryl, didn't you, exploring her family tree?
Yeah, she did Who Do You Think You Are a few years ago, and turns out that her ancestors were all mariners from North Shields. So we filmed an episode down there, which was really interesting. She was dead canny, dead down to earth. She had an entourage with her, but she was it was good fun. It's still on YouTube. It was a good laugh, actually.
Yeah, check that out, and check out Dan's book as well. Every Northeasterner should own a copy of that book. It's great. So, Paul, we'll start with you. The last episode heard us close out with the club picking up the pieces after the war. Attendances and finances quickly recovered, didn't they? And Newcastle wasted no time reassembling quite a talented squad again, and it seemed like business as usual by the end of 1921. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's probably right. Recovery after the Great War was more or less complete by the end of 1920-21. United again did well that season, finishing in fifth place, and the bank balance was replenished, and that all led to something of a spending spree. New men to arrive for the new season were Billy Aitken. He cost £2,500. Dan Seymour, another £2,500, and we'll talk about him a little bit later on. Tom MacDonald cost £2,000. He went on to score over 100 goals for the Magpies, and also a record club signing of a new centre-forward called Neil Harris. He cost nearly £3,500, and all of them came from Scotland.
Yes, that rich Scottish seam of footballing talent being tapped into again. Can you talk us through how the two preceding seasons went between the end of the war and between Newcastle's first trip to Wembley at the end of the 1923-24 season, and some of the new heroes on the pitch at St James's Park?
Yeah, well, 1921-1922 was a bit of a disappointment after spending a lot of money. They finished mid-table, but the following year, in 22-23, they finished in fourth spot and made a late surge towards challenging for the title. But it was all too late. Neil Harris was a top leader, and he was one of Newcastle's centre-forward heroes in a long line of them, maybe one of the least recalled, but he scored 101 goals and 194 appearances, which is a terrific record. He came from Partick Thistle, and for four and a half seasons, he led the line with gusto in season 1923-24, when Newcastle reached Wembley, he scored 23 goals, was on fire all season, and starred in the final and in the showpiece a week or so later in the England v Scotland game. And he was later a manager when he retired, and his son, John Harris, was a long-serving manager with Sheffield United after being a top player with Chelsea.
Great. Yeah, Neil Harris, not a name I'm too familiar with, so great to shed some light on him. He scored over 100 goals for the club, so not to be sniffed at all. Dan, to bring you in, can you shed any more light on post-World War One Newcastle United and maybe a bit about the economic picture of the 1920s in the North East generally?
Yeah, well, I think that we shouldn't underestimate just how big a shadow the First World War cast on the North East of England for a number of reasons. One was it's a kind of watershed of its industrial and economic preeminence. It reaches a kind of pinnacle before the First World War in terms of demand for its products. It gets a boost by the First World War in terms of armaments, manufacture on the Tyne and so on. It becomes a massive employer, and there's a huge economic boom, which pretty quickly recedes, actually, as peace arrives from 1918 onwards. So it's a kind of last hurrah of that golden age of the industrial northeast. There were some mini peaks after that, but it was never quite the same again after the First World War. And then the experience of fighting the First World War was massive on the northeast. I've written quite a bit about this, that basically no other part of the United Kingdom responded more enthusiastically to Kitchener's call for men in 1914 than the northeast of England. And the response 1914, the memorial at the Haymarket is a fantastic illustration of that. You know, men just joining up in their working clothes, you know, a big gang of them. It's meant to represent a column of Northumberland Fusiliers leaving the town. And no British Army regiment raised more battalions than the Northumberland Fusiliers, 55 in the First World War. Durham Light Infantry raised north of 40. These just huge numbers, and inevitably, therefore, the casualties were enormous. If you've ever been to Thiepval on the Western Front and you just see the DLI and the Fusiliers lists, and these are just the men that they couldn't find, the memorial to the missing, thousands and thousands. 1,644 Northumberland Fusiliers were killed on the 1st of July 1916 alone, and most of them before 12 o'clock in the morning, in the afternoon, sorry. Horrific. I mean, I worked on a project called the Tynemouth World War One Commemoration Project, which looked at and delved into the 1,700 men from the old borough of Tynemouth, which was basically North Shields, who were killed in the First World War. And that was just a massive number. And I think we underestimate the impact that must have had in terms of missing men at home, the trauma of all that, and the kind of ubiquity of military service. And we'll get onto the lineups, but, you know, there's at least... For the biographical information I've got, there's at least six of the Newcastle players that day were First World War veterans, including the captain, Frank Hudspeth, who was an able seaman in the Royal Navy in the First World War. But a huge impact, and it cast a really long shadow on the region, and it, to a large extent, I don't think it ever really recovered from the First World War.
Yeah, amazing to hear that, amazing to hear those numbers, and actually fills you with pride to be from this area, the response that the region galvanised for World War One, and among those men were some staff and players associated with the club, which we spoke about in our last episode.
Footnote, sorry, I should just say that women's football became enormously popular during the First World War as men's football was put on hold, and you had the all-conquering Blythe Spartans ladies winning the National Munitionettes Cup with their lethal centre-forward Bella Ray. I think she got about 120 goals in 1918. But it's interesting that the football authorities quickly stamped down on women's football after the end of the First World War. It was kind of like, and the same applied in the workplace as well. It was kind of like a pretty patriarchal get back to the kitchen sink message in the workplace and in terms of ladies' football, which set back the women's game for decades, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Alex Jackson touched upon that in our last episode. Alex Jackson from the National Football Museum. He didn't give us the detail on Blythe, though. It was great to hear that they were thriving up in Northumberland. But yeah, shame that it was one step forward, a number of steps back after World War One for the women's game. Paul, the new National Stadium then in the suburb of Wembley, it was ready by 1923. Why the move from Crystal Palace? Not that Newcastle fans would have been complaining having watched their team or seen their team lose almost half a dozen games there in the Edwardian era.
Well, yes, that's right. Newcastle fans were more than happy to see the back of the Crystal Palace, albeit that they did go there in the 20s, and we'll come to that in another episode. But the Sydenham Arena was an awful venue for spectators. It had low terracing, only one stand. The fans couldn't really see much of the action when you had a huge crowd in the stadium. So the authorities started looking for a new venue well before the Great War, and they moved around to one or two stadiums before the 1920s. So by 1923, the country had a new national football stadium. It was called back then the Empire Stadium, situated in North London at Wembley. But soon, of course, to be known just simply as Wembley to every football fan, not only in the UK, but in the wider Europe and around the world many years later. The old Crystal Palace was ditched, and the very first FA Cup final in 1923 was between West Ham and Bolton, and that attracted a monumental crowd, estimated by some around 300,000 congregated on the new stadium, which was capped at 125,000. And mayhem followed, really. Of course, that led to massive overcrowding, and the famous white police horse called Billy entered the pitch to try and clear the area before the game could start. So after that sort of fiasco, all the cup finals became all ticket matches, and Newcastle United were going to play in the very first all-ticket game.
Mm, what an honour, yes. Of course, famous images of the horse. Amazing no one was seriously injured in that final, with more than double the attendance supposedly turning up. We'll talk in detail about the final in a bit, but I just thought, Paul, if you could tell us how the season itself began domestically prior to the Cup starting in January.
Yeah, well, season 1923-1924 was much like the previous one. United were again challenging just outside the top places. They played some good football, but they finished in ninth position. They had plenty of goals in the side, with Harris, Tom McDonald, Stan Seymour, all a danger up front and always grabbing goals. But after the turn of the year, the focus was on the FA Cup and the new home of football, as it was going to be called, and its landmark Twin Towers, which would become a real landmark for every football follower.
Of course, yeah. So huge incentive to make the final. Newcastle managed it. Dan, any notes on their route to the final? There seemed to be a lot of goals, a lot of drama, some replays.
Yeah, there is, and there's some great photographs and newsreel footage of that cup run. There's I think it's one of the earlier round games away at Watford, mm-hmm. and Newcastle wear their very rarely seen black V diamond shirt. If you've ever seen that one before, there's a great photograph of Frank Hudspeth leading the team out with the black V on. Mm-hmm. And standing aside, he's often visible, is, what's his first name again? Paul will know this. Is it Thomas Oliver? One of the, he was the secretary stroke, chairman stroke. He was on the board, wasn't he?
There was two or three Olivers. Frank Watt was the secretary. Oliver at the time was chairman. He was the director, James Lunn, I think Oliver was chairman and then James Lunn, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's come back to me now. Hudspeth's leading the team out, and there's Frank Watt with his big handlebar moustache and big watch chain and all that. And then there's the other side is Thomas Oliver, I'm pretty sure was his name. He often appears in these photographs in that very, it's probably Peaky Blinders era, this, in terms of the gents' fashion and haircuts and everything. They look really smart. Frank Hudspeth, as you said, Matt, looks hard as nails leading them out. Cheers, lad. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a thriller. But then On YouTube, there's a pretty decent British Pathé highlights package of the semi-final at St Andrews in Birmingham against Man City. And as often, with these kind of footage from the 1920s, it can look a bit disjointed at times. But the package ends with a cross from the left wing and Neil Harris, who we've already talked about, who was this kind of glamorous Jack Grealish-type figure with this mop of dark hair, just leaps like a salmon, bullet header, and the hair's waving around, and he wheels away. It's genuinely, it looks, a lot of that kind of older football can look very antiquated, but it doesn't. It's called, partly because it's still the era where players had their shirts out, before they started tucking them in more regularly from the 1930s. They just look a bit, they almost look modern. And I think, Paul will correct me if I'm wrong, it was only from about 1920 that Newcastle started wearing black shorts, wasn't it? More regularly. It was blue until the First World War, was it?
Yeah, it was 1920s. They switched on a permanent basis to black. And certainly the clips on Pathé and Hughes, which you can see on the web, they must have about 30 or 40 clips of Newcastle games over the years. And they're all worth a watch to anybody who is interested in the history of Newcastle United, because they're wonderful.
Yeah,
we'll try and link to some of those in the show notes, for because that Watford game in particular sounds amazing, and it's getting on for 100 years ago now as well, which spectacular. Paul, any other details on the famous run to Wembley this season?
Well, yes, there was one special tie. Yeah, the whole run was incident packed and included. It was a marvellous tie with Derby County, which went to four games, believe it or not, 420 minutes of football, 20 goals, and eventually decided at St James's Park with a 5-3 Newcastle victory. The Magpies met Aston Villa in the final. But just before the game, they rested almost the whole side in a league meeting with their Wembley opponents at Villa Park. And that was just in case anyone got injured. They lost 6-1, as it happened, and ironically, goalkeeper Sandy Much, virtually the only first-teamer who played, was badly crocked and missed the final. It was unlucky for the veteran Scottish keeper, but in stepped a local lad, Bill Bradley, and he performed well at Wembley. And as it happens, he later ran a shop in North Shields for many years.
How about that? Very harsh on Sandy Much, but fair play to Bill Bradley for stepping up. Such a huge game. So let's set the scene then, Paul. In early summer 1924, Newcastle fans were presumably ecstatic to secure a trip to the new stadium so early. Tell us about the mood among fans. Is it true that some travelled on foot to Wembley? I read that in your book, The Ultimate Record.
Well, if it's in there, it must be true. The year 1924, that year was the cup final, coincided with the Vast Empire Exhibition, which was fielded next to the stadium, where millions of visitors saw the sights of the vast British Empire. Newcastle supporters headed for London and for Wembley for the very first time, and many of them must have taken in the exhibition as well. They travelled by train, some on steamers from the Tyne and down in the North Sea, and several wonderful pictures exist of them getting onto the boats from the quayside. And yes, even a few walked all the way to London, nearly 300 miles or so. Not quite sure if it was sponsored or whatever, but they did it by foot, and not quite sure if they came back that way either.
Unbelievable. Dan, anything to add to that? The Geordie invasion on London, it would surprise people to know how many Newcastle fans actually travelled for these occasions. It was large numbers, not small numbers.
No, definitely not. I think, I don't know which cup final it is, but there is those great photographs of fans leaving the Tyne by packet steamer and getting on boats down to the Thames to follow Newcastle. But I wouldn't be surprised if they went by foot. Interestingly, you're starting to see a lot more movement in general terms in the Northeast, because as I touched on earlier about the First World War being this watershed, you're starting to see that economic decline. And you're starting to see kind of unemployment emerge as a huge challenge in the interwar period. And for those on Twitter who might have been following the exploits of Hanwell Town, based in Middlesex, not far from Wembley, actually, who were formed in 1920 by exiled Geordie, I think railway workers, or it might be construction workers, I can't quite recall. But it's an interesting example of, even as early as 1920, people were leaving the Northeast in search of work. So that's 100 years ago, you know, when the economy was starting to decline and people were uprooting down south, which was booming in contrast to the north, you know, light industry, that whole kind of western end of London, arterial roads heading west. You've got Hoover factories and all sorts of things cropping up in a way that the heavy industries of the north, shipbuilding and coal mining, were on the downward spiral.
Yeah, great shout, Hanwell Town. Do check those out. Check Hanwell Town out, listener. They're
known as the Geordies, aren't they?
Yes, they're playing black and white. Yeah. And I mean, until recently, I was living in London, not far from Hanwell Town, and they actually had a player called Andy O'Brien, which I thought was fantastic, captained them. So there's a lot of crossover there, and there's talk of, you know, Newcastle fans all going to a Hanwell Town game in ahead of a London away fixture when fans are able to return to games. So that would be great, a pilgrimage to Hanwell, who were founded by Geordies 100 years ago. Great story. Back to the 1924 final then. Can you talk us through some of the players who made the starting lineup, please, Paul?
United side, as I said before, was a decent one. And apart from the likes of Seymour and Tom MacDonald, which we touched on before, as well as Neil Harris at centre forward, there was two new signings, two more Scottish internationals in Willie Cowan and Billy Gibson, both very talented midfield players. They were captained by a Geordie fullback, which we mentioned, Frank Hudspeth from Percy Maine. He went on to total 482 games for Newcastle over the years. He started just before the war and finished at the end of the 20s. When he scored 38 goals, he was something of a penalty expert, banging the balls into the net. So they had a good side, but they were up against an equally talented Aston Villa lineup.
Yeah, 482 games for Hudspeth's amazing. And you think how many he would have recorded had it not been for the World War. So that's surely something.
Hudspeth I've forgotten his name now. Bill McCracken kind of pioneered that work on the offside trap before the First World War.
He certainly did, and we'll Hudspeth and McCracken. McCracken started it just before the First World War, and the pair of them continued in the early 20s, and we'll cover and touch on that in the next episode after the cup final when everything came to a head, and because of their specialised tactic, the FA had to change the rules.
Absolutely brilliant. Just to have such a grasp on the game that the rules have to be altered is unprecedented, really. So fair play to Frank Hudspeth and Bill McCracken for that. So that we mentioned that the first FA Cup final at Wembley was quite chaotic, and the FA made sure this was an all-ticket affair for safety, if anything. What was the official attendance estimated at, Paul? I assume it was a little lower than the 300,000 that was estimated the year before. And what type of game did they see when it started?
It certainly was lower than that. The official attendance was nearly 100,000. It was in the 90s. But all had to have the precious tickets. And even these days, those tickets for collectors cost a pretty penny. Mm. They saw a good final. It was an even contest for much of the game, with Bill Bradley stopping the Aston Villa attacks on several occasions. But in the second half, United secured the trophy with two fairly late goals in the 80th and in the 80 minutes area. Neil Harris and Stan Seymour scored them, and Frank Hudspeth climbed what were to become the famous Wembley steps for the first time and collected the trophy. And that trophy they collected was the first time that Newcastle had actually won that, because back in 1910, they actually won the old FA Cup, or English Cup, as it was called then.
Yeah, big deal. So Stan Seymour was on the score sheet. He's a name that is synonymous with Newcastle United. Can you talk to us a bit more about him, please, Paul?
Yeah, well, he was one of Newcastle's greatest characters. Mr. Newcastle, he was eventually called. A player, a critic, a director, manager, and chairman. He was from County Durham, from Kello. He was actually rejected by the club as a kid after a trial for being far too small. And that story has reoccurred up for many players, to be honest. He joined Bradford City later on, then headed to Scotland, where he became a noted winger with Greenock Morton. But by 1920, he was a wanted man. Several English clubs wanted to bring him back south. And Newcastle spent £2,500 to secure his signature in May 1920. And he went on to appear right through the 20s for the club, a key figure as they won the FA Cup, as we've just talked about, and then the league title. He was always able to score goals, 84 he got in 266 games. But that wasn't the end of his career with Newcastle by a long way. He eventually retired and was something of a critic during the 1930s. He wrote a spot in the Evening Chronicle, a regular spot, and in Newcastle weren't very good in the later years of the 30s, and he was a fierce critic. But remarkably, the club directors recognised that they need to do something at St James's Park, and he was brought back as a director in 1938, just before the Second World War. And that was very much a rarity to have an ex-player on a closed shop board of directors. And for the next 30-odd years, he had a huge influence on the club. He was manager in all but name from, you know, during the 1940s and many of the years of the 1950s. He became chairman, earned the title of Mr. Newcastle everywhere he went. He was more or less manager for those three FA Cup wins in the 1950s. And also famous for opening up his sports outfit shop in Newcastle, which for any Newcastle fan of many generations, they popped into occasionally. It's still, I believe, called Seymour's Corner near the Theatre Royal. And that was a famous spot in the city. And his son, Stan Seymour Jr., also became a director, of course, and later chairman. So he has a huge part to play in the history of Newcastle United from the 1920s onwards.
Absolutely, yes. Some story. Dan, anything to add on this period, the game, Stan Seymour, any of the other characters involved with the club at the time?
Well, yeah, what I think is interesting is, you know, Stan Seymour's County Durham lad, and the classic mixture of Northeast players and Scottish players in the Newcastle lineup that day. But on the Aston Villa side, you've got Billy Curtin, who was an England international, and he's from Newcastle. He was their inside right that day. He was from Pandon, right in the heart of the city, actually.
Yeah.
And he'd scored the winner in 1920 when Aston Villa had won the sixth FA Cup. And alongside him that day was Clem Stevenson from Seton Delaval, who was another England international who went on to win three league titles with Huddersfield Town. One of the greatest players of the 1920s, in fact, who Stevenson was they said his passes were as sweet as stolen kisses. So it was just as early as the 1920s. There was, you know, the old thing about Geordie players, the one that got away, you know, whether it's Bobby Charlton or whatever. But, you know, it was happening back then because the Northeast was producing this surplus of footballers. They usually emerged from those coal mining communities. So it was fairly typical. But yeah, Aston Villa, it's always worth just running the rule again, going down the player list for the opposition, because you'll always find Northeast players in that period on both sides usually.
Yeah, wow, brilliant detail. So Geordies haven't always been, you know, performing for other clubs. It's happened for as long as 100 years. It's amazing to know that. Great stat. We've got a little bit of bonus content then for people watching on our YouTube channel or on video embedded on our website. Click the link in the description. You should be able to find this image we're looking at now of Newcastle captain Frank Hudspeth standing on the pitch at Wembley, having just collected the FA Cup trophy. And he's posing alongside a caped police officer. Guys, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this amazing image. It's quite a crowded pitch area and Hudspeth looking hard as nails, quite frankly.
Yeah, and the policeman's wearing the cape because it was a wet day, wasn't it? And I only know this from Wikipedia, but it says that it was a rainy afternoon. And because a lot of the ground wasn't under cover, people were using the match programmes as sort of makeshift umbrellas, really. So it means that the match programme is very rare because they were all sopping wet by the end of the afternoon. But it's a fantastic image. It's one of the most iconic images, I'd say. You all know the kind of Jackie Milburn era, but this image of Hudspeth, great Newcastle shirt, that with a massive kind of civic crest on the chest. Mm-hmm. He's got his shirt untucked. I mentioned that his Royal Navy career in the First World War, and I think he ended up as a physical training instructor in the Royal Navy at the end of the war, and it's no surprise given his athletic prowess, but it's a great image.
Just continuing on, Frank Hudspeth, ironically, he was, as you say, in the Royal Navy, and he was stationed at, believe it or not, the Crystal Palace for 2 or 3 years, because the Crystal Palace was taken over by the Navy, and there was a huge naval training complex there, and that's where Frank ended up with several other Newcastle players at the time.
Brilliant. Legend. Chaps, great episode. It really is just amazing to discuss Newcastle winning trophies. Never tire of that. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Dan, for joining us for this one. Hopefully we'll be able to get you back on for future episodes in the series.
Thanks very much.
And away the check out. Yes, exactly. And as I said at the top of the show, do check out Dan's book, The Northumbrians. I think every Northeasterner will appreciate it. And, of course, every Newcastle fan should have a copy of Paul's book as well, Newcastle United, The Ultimate Record. We'll be back next week to chat about Newcastle United winning more silverware, this time the league title, so don't miss that because it's the last time it ever happened. And in the meantime, please subscribe to the Everything is Black and White podcast via whichever podcast platform you use. Follow Chronicle Live Newcastle United to channels on social media. We're at Chronicle NUFC on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And keep an eye out for new episodes of Chronicle, the history of Newcastle United. We're doing these every week. And if you have a history question about Newcastle United, then email us at the eibwpodcast@reachplc.com. We have experts like Paul and Dan here who might be able to answer some of those. And stay up to date with everything black and white by subscribing to our daily Newcastle United newsletter. It's free. You get a morning news roundup, an evening news roundup, and breaking news as and when it happens, directly emailed to your inbox. The link is in the show notes. Hit that, scroll down to Sport, Newcastle United Updates, tick the box, and you'll be signed up. So thanks very much for listening to Chronicle, the history of Newcastle United, with me, Matt Ketchell, Paul Joannou, and Dr. Dan Jackson.